new chairs and get some new mics set up and tell you that you're really in for a treat. As if the previous three panels haven't been good enough, we have assembled America's leading historians and thought leaders and intellectuals who are now coming up to the stage behind me to begin what I'm sure is going to be an incredible conversation. Why don't you all, I'm going to sit down here so I can see you. And Ken Davis would be is there. This is like a good dinner party. Excellent. Great. Alan Cooperman, right there. Good. Professor Wills would be great. Is just over there okay, so I can sit on the end? Yeah, that's perfect. And you're right over there. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Sam Tannenhaus, Alan Cooperman, Ken Davis, and the great Gary Wills. I shouldn't play favorites as the moderator, but I have to admit that I'm starstruck sitting next to Professor Wills, whose work I've so long admired. And I would like to ask you, Professor Wills, in addition to really being the most distinguished American cultural historian of your generation, you began writing about the conservative movement. Yes. And I want to ask you about the conservatives on the Supreme Court. We've heard about divisions between libertarians like Anthony Kennedy, institutionalists like John Roberts, traditionalists like Sam Alito, social conservatives like Scalia. How do you detect the arc of the evolution of the conservative movement working out on the current Supreme Court?
I don't know.
Thanks a lot. That's not helpful.
My anti-communist Catholic conservatism of the 1950s hardly applies to what goes on now. But I think what David Lenhardt said about it's not accidental that the decisions are now being made by Republican appointees and Democratic appointees, it's not accidental. And the thing about that is that it affects voting behavior or non-behavior. The right-wing Republicans in America have voted in terms of the Supreme Court, not only in presidential elections, but in other elections for Congress, because they know that Congress has to, the Senate has to ratify an appointee to the Supreme Court. For years now, a way to rouse the crowd on the right wing was to denounce the Supreme Court. They hated a whole series of Supreme Court decisions, the segregation, the parent school, the abortion. And so people voted in those terms. Democrats, in large part, did not. That is, you didn't go out to most Democratic venues and say, don't we hate the Supreme Court? We've got to change it. So whatever kind of conservative they ended up with, they wanted to end up with a conservative. And to a great deal of extent, they have. And of course, they thought they were winning the big prize of all with Scalia. He was their genius. It was thought that he would be the brains of the Supreme Court. And the interesting thing is that he thought it. And he is now extremely taking as a personal insult that people are not following his advice. Mariah in the Twelfth Night says about Malvolio, he is so crammed in his thoughts with excellencies that he cannot think anybody would disagree with him. And so when you disagree with the great intellectual Scalia, he becomes the kind of intellectual who says, I'll punish you, I'll put a bag on my head if you follow this majority, which might improve the landscape, would muffle his message, but he thinks to deprive you of me is my supreme return.
Sam Tannenhaus, you have picked up Gary Wills' mantle as chronicler of the conservative movement.
Nobody picks up Gary Wills' mantle. Well, I've carried the train now.
You've done a beautiful and important job in tracing out the fissures and affinities in the modern conservative movement. Do you agree with Gary Wills that Justice Scalia's wing of social conservatism has lost the culture war? And what further light could you cast about the dissonances among the current conservative justices and how it reflects broader divisions in conservatism today.
Well, I'm going to reveal the full extent of my Gary Wills idolatry by quoting an essay I reread all the time. It was published in David Leonhardt's and my former publication, New York Times. New York Times Sunday Magazine, January 25th, I believe, 1998. It's called Whatever Happened to Politics. And it was written just at the moment that the Monica Lewinsky case broke. And what Gary did with his typical, frighteningly broad erudition was to show how two things. Politics and culture are inseparable, and cultural changes happen first. Gary had a session this morning, brilliant session, many of you saw it, with Michael Gerson and Matt Malone talking about Pope Francis. And one of the arguments was that he's a great leader because he's a follower. The changes have happened in the culture, and this is where the conservatives lag behind. Now, there are some things to keep in mind. We look a lot at changes in demographics, the tremendously influential Pew Research poll about millennials. We now know that they're a larger population than the baby boomers, people like me. 43% are not white, but look closely. Pew will tell you whom they voted for. Under 30 whites in America voted for Mitt Romney. The racial issue will not go away. The numbers have shifted. The demographics have shifted. A phrase we haven't heard mentioned today, I'm a little surprised by it, and I'm not a constitutional scholar at all, is a Federalist Society. And that's where someone like Scalia came out. I think, Jeff, you'd know this best, almost all the conservative justices on the court now had some connection with the Federalist Society. Is that right?
Well, they have spoken before it. The younger ones have been members, but I do want to say, in the nonpartisan spirit of the National Constitution Center, we have a superb coalition between the Federalist Society, the conservative group, and the American Constitution Society, the liberal group, and they're co-hosting a series of debates and podcasts and symposia. So I do think that basically all liberals and conservatives today are members of one group or the other, and both are committed to this sort of debate.
The Federalist Society is really important because, for one reason, one of its leaders actually was the son of one of the great early conservatives, who was a mentor to Gary, and also in the early days at National Review, and also because they helped establish this idea. I don't know how to think of it. It's almost a kind of inverse Leo Straussianism, if that doesn't sound like the most pretentious thing you've heard today, it probably is, which is a kind of fanatically fixated originalism, looking at texts, at language, in a very close, narrow way. I say reverse Straussianism because Leo Strauss's idea was that if you got below the surface of the language, you saw what people really meant. And Scalia and others have taken that idea and kind of flipped it around and said, well, let's be like the new critics of the 1930s, the literary critics, and look only at the phrase itself and build a kind of philosophy out of it. That was the semantic hole, the rabbit hole that the conservatives went into in this last decision. And what they missed is where the country is. And what surprised me about Chief Justice Roberts, because I wasn't sure at first, is he does seem more attuned to a couple of things that have come up here. One is the dysfunctionality of government seems so great, the legislature in particular. This is a moment for the Supreme Court to dominate. This could be a great era for the court, as the 1950s were for the Warren Court. And second, that he listens to where the country is. So on something like marriage equality, it was decided in the country a long time ago. 37 states, I think, is the latest count. Not only that, as some very smart conservative writers, bloggers have pointed out, the idea of what we used to be called homosexual marriage has been with us for a very long time. There are many same-sex people who essentially are married. We think of them as married. We know them. They're in our families. So the court there is catching up. The conservative movement, amazingly, has not. And here's the last thing I'll say before smarter people can jump in, is the model for the conservatives will be one of two. Are they going to follow the example of the Brown decision, which you'll remember, initially, we think of it as having been absorbed by the culture. No, not initially. 100 legislators in Washington signed the Southern Manifesto, senators and congressmen, and they said, we will not let the Supreme Court dictate to us on school integration. It took all three branches. The Congress had to pass a very weak civil rights bill, but they nonetheless did it in 1957, begun in 55 by the Eisenhower administration, initiated by it, and Eisenhower himself had to close the circle with the third branch of government in Little Rock. Okay, so it took all three branches, and yet it worked. That's what happened. The leader in the Senate who stopped the filibuster, by the way, not one Republican senator voted against that civil rights bill in 1957. Every nay vote came from a Dixiecrat. That's how the parties have changed. Well, the Senate leader who kept the filibuster from going beyond its limit was Strom Thurmond, who set a record for a marathon filibuster, was Lyndon Johnson. And when Johnson got elected president, then we closed the circle again with the later voting civil rights, voting rights. It took essentially 10 years for it to happen. Now with marriage equality, we're looking at something that goes back really about 20 years now, right? 1996, more or less, through the stages up till now. If this conservative movement, if its leaders choose not to follow that model of accommodation that Republicans or conservatives did after the Brown decision, but instead turn it into Roe v. Wade and look for every opportunity to oppose and overturn, they may find themselves really out of step.
Alan Cooperman, Sam just said that the court, cultural change comes first and then political change. You, in your work at Pew, have overseen the best empirical research on this. Tell us, is the court in or out of step with the country on marriage equality, on religion, and on race?
Well, quick, easy question. Thank you.
Sure, no problem.
I'm not sure that the change in attitudes towards same-sex marriage is completely unprecedented in American life. Because it became before the advent of modern polling, we don't know, for example, how quickly the population turned from support of prohibition to opposition to prohibition. But in the analogs of modern polling, there is nothing like, in the annals of modern polling, there's nothing, no analog to what has happened with same-sex marriage. As recently as 5 years ago, we still had more opposition than support to same-sex marriage. Our polling does go back on this question. We've asked the same question consistently since 1996. Let's just take 2001 as a good example. You'll hear why in a moment. In 2001, we had 57% opposed to same-sex marriage, 39% in favor. Today, we have 57% in favor, 35% opposed. The numbers have almost flipped in 14 years. That is extraordinary. Now, don't misunderestimate, as President Bush would have said, there are still deep reservoirs of opposition. So among self-described conservative Republicans, they are still 3-1 opposed to same-sex marriage. Among white evangelical Protestants, still more than 2.5-1. And among African Americans, who, as you know, overall lean quite Democratic, still 51% are opposed to same-sex marriage. So there's been a lot of change. Every part of the population, every demographic group has moved more in favor, but there's still a lot of opposition. Now, why have people moved in favor? You all can see it in your daily lives, but one of the things that jumps out in polling is there's a very clear correlation between whether you know a person who is gay or lesbian and how you feel on this issue. And the percentage of the public that says they know a gay person has risen very rapidly. In the 1990s, it was about 6 in 10. Today, it's pushing 9 in 10. It's 88%. And among younger Americans, an overwhelming number not only say they know a gay person, but say they know a lot of gay people. Another very important correlate is whether you think that being gay or lesbian is something innate or it's a choice. The American public is still somewhat divided on this, but the share that think that it is innate has been rising. And a third very important correlate is religious. So People who think that their religious tradition has a problem with homosexuality, that their religious tradition is in conflict with homosexuality, are still more than 2-to-1 opposed to same-sex marriage. We can tell from the National Congregation Survey, however, that the share of American religious bodies, groups, churches, that now allow gays and lesbians to be full members of their churches has been rising, rising, rising. And you can see this in the recent decisions by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, by the Presbyterian Church, by the Episcopal Church, and so on, all moving in the direction of allowing gays and lesbians, allowing ministers to conduct same-sex marriages, and so on. So it really has been, a shift. It's come on the heels. It's the caboose, if you will, of a much longer movement toward gay rights, changing attitudes toward homosexuality. We should bear in mind this has been going on for a long time. But I think 5 years, just 5 years ago, there were more Americans opposed to same-sex marriage than supporting it. It's been quite a shift.
Thanks for that great and comprehensive response.
What about Latin America? I'm sorry.
We need to, in the moderating spirit, move along. You have a quick question about Latin America?
I was just going to ask about Latino Americans. You gave where they stand on.
Yeah, Latinos, I think, today have moved a great deal. And what's interesting, and probably now, I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but probably majority support. And it's really been the middle of the political spectrum that's moved the most. So religiously unaffiliated people and Democrats always supported same-sex marriage and are now more in support. But it's interesting, the greatest moves have been among Catholics, right? Including white Catholics as well as Hispanic Catholics, so there are big differences. And people who describe themselves as moderates. Those groups have moved 15 percentage points in the direction, or even 20 percentage points.
Great. For the last word on this extraordinarily substantive panel, we have Ken Davis, one of the leading thinkers on healthcare. Ken, what is next? The Affordable Care Act has been upheld. What are the next debates about healthcare going to look like?
Well, that's the question. What we have is a hyper-partisan situation around healthcare. And I'm going to tell you two vignettes that answer your question. The first has to do with when the bill was being operationalized, when the bill was being written. And a number of CEOs of the major academic medical centers would come down to Washington regularly, and we would meet with the health legislative aides who are from the health committee, and they would talk to us about how they were writing it, and we would try to input pragmatic issues. So one evening, we were there. We were talking to the committee, and they said, we just had a great day. We really, really got close. We figured out what to do about your uncompensated care and how we're going to deal with your uncompensated care when the number of people who are insured go up. And we listened, and they said, it's simple. All we're going to do is decrease your uncompensated care directly in proportion to the new patients that you're going to get who previously couldn't afford insurance. And we looked at them and we said, well, what about the undocumenteds? And they went, the undocumenteds. And then somebody else says, we can't do anything about the undocumenteds because you remember in the State of the Union address when the president said, illegal immigrants will not be covered, someone screamed out, a congressman, you're a liar. So this, we're not going to be able to go back to that one. They said, what you better do is go talk to your local senators and see if we can get that fixed. So her partners from New York Presbyterian and I ran down to Chuck Schumer's office and we said, we've got a big problem here because they're going to decrease our uncompensated care pool directly proportional to the increase that they think there'll be in the number of insured. And that won't work because we're going to still be left with a big hunk of people who are uninsured. Chuck says, you know, we'll have to fix that after the bill passes. Because every major piece of legislation, you know, gets fixed like this. We'll just have to wait. Well, we're still waiting. The other issue, what now that I'd like to, I know we're running out of time, that I'd want to talk about is, so what comes next? What comes next is not only fixing these little things, but also fixing the big things. And one of the big things is, how are we going to bend the cost curve? How are we going to make this bill provide affordable health care for employers, employees, the government, whether that's state or federal? And the answer to that is, we've got to start looking at chronic disease, which is 70% of our costs. We have to start looking at death and dying. Last year of life, depending on the survey you look at, 30% of Medicare dollars is spent in the last year of life. often for care that if you had an advance directive, you wouldn't have wanted anyway. Well, so my daughter happened to be a health legislative aide. She was working for Senator Whitehouse. So I said to her once, Jordy, I have a great solution to this problem. I said, all we need to do is when everybody signs up for Medicare, they also have to sign up with an advance directive. They have to fill out forms and tell you what they like, and they can keep modifying that. And she says, you know, Dad, that one's dead on arrival. The inability to deal with some critical healthcare issues that are driving healthcare costs is absolutely frightening. We've turned this into social issues that really shouldn't cloud what are the pragmatic issues, partisan issues that shouldn't befuddle what should require some simple solutions. And the consequence is that we can despair for the hope that in the next couple years we'll fix what has to be fixed. But hopefully, down the road, when this becomes utterly unaffordable, when the Alzheimer's epidemic overwhelms Medicare, when the type 2 diabetes epidemic overcomes Medicare, someone's going to begin to really think hard about the changes that are absolutely essential.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have about 10 minutes for questions, but please first join me in thanking our historians and thought leaders. This has been a kind of constitutional Disneyland, I think, and thank you so much for bearing with us. You can ask questions either of the people who are on stage or of Senator Coons, Neil Katyal, our two journalists who are still here. Try to keep it short, and please pose your question to particular people. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Mary Ann Stein, and I'd like to ask whoever wants to answer it, one of the issues that was not maybe on the forefront this year in the Supreme Court is the abortion issue. But for many people, there's a big concern that something major is going to happen in the court. And I just wonder, in terms of the things you've talked about, of the court, the various rationales for different justices deciding the ways they do, what you think may be going to happen here.
Maybe I'll point these initially to Neil. The court has just taken an abortion case or is about to. What's next in a court on abortion? Senator Coons, why don't you come up as well?
The last time the Supreme Court really heard the abortion issue in full measure was in the Casey decision in 1992, in which you had Justices Souter and O'Connor and Kennedy all writing a controlling opinion saying Roe versus Wade is the law of the land. They've dealt with some other issues, partial birth abortion and so on in the subsequent years, but nothing big. This year very well may be that year. A case out of Texas looks like one that the court is interested in. We'll find out more later this summer. But it does look like abortion is heading to the court. I think it is a very difficult one to predict because Justice Kennedy's views appear to have changed a bit. He indicated a bit more hostility to Roe versus Wade in his most recent partial birth abortion opinion.
Interesting.
Oh, Jeff, can
yes,
I just...
Yes, sir. Let's, because we have so few, let's... yes, sir, in the back. Great.
I'm wondering if you would speculate on what the next vacancy is going to be on the court and when it's going to happen.
Huh. This is totally unfair because no one knows but Chris.
I mean, I really think that's very difficult to know because it's a combination of sort of health and energy and political trajectory and who's likely to be in the position to choose their successors. So I think it's really hard to decide. There's been a lot of concern about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, obviously. She's pushed back fairly publicly on that and I think has demonstrated a fierce engagement and capability. So I frankly think it's premature for me to be guessing based on an unknown series of factors for a number of justices who are at a stage in their careers where it might be reasonable to retire.
The odds are overwhelming that the next president will appoint at least one Supreme Court justice, if not more. Ginsburg, Kennedy, Scalia, Breyer, none of them is young. The odds are overwhelming the next president will get at least one and probably more than one.
But it could be three, right?
Yes, sir.
Can't get away without Senator and Neil, if you might comment on Citizens United. I mean, that's another huge.
The only constitutional amendment that I've been willing to support is one that would make an attempt at repealing, revising Citizens United. I think that the capacity of a few citizens to effectively drown out. Well, I took a stab at explaining it. I have my twin 16-year-old boys with me, and we had a very long drive over Independence Pass on our way here. And one of them asked me what this thing was that I talked about, and trying to explain to them why free speech is important, is protected, and is one of our foundational values, yet in some settings, some types of speech really pose a risk to our whole constitutional order or to public safety or in other settings. And in those cases, we can manage or restrict speech. It's a very hard thing to explain in simple terms, unless and until you show them the numbers of how much a few individuals are able to contribute and how much it really deflects the trajectory of elections and of the Congress as a whole, then they seem to agree.
Great. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Let me preface my question by saying I have tremendous respect for everybody who participated in the panel, but it's 2015, we have more women on the bench than we've ever had, we have a woman running for president, and I've watched 10 men on this stage and there's been no women. Why is that?
Completely fair and appropriate question. Nancy Gibbs from Time was supposed to join us but wasn't able to, and we made some other unsuccessful attempts to remedy the preposterous unrepresentativeness of this group of white guys, so our apologies, we'll try better next time. The fact that it's relevant and that you're sitting here looking at this group and finding it hard to see us as representing the diversity of American views is a great thing, and I've found in constructing panels at the National Constitution Center too, diversity matters, and this is a reflection of changes in society. Hopefully this kind of panel will not be at Aspen next year. So thank you very much.
Let me say one word about that, because it's, you know, this is an Aspen panel, but let's talk about what's actually happening in the real world. So if you look at, for example, who argued cases in the US Supreme Court last year, 15% of the cases argued by women, 15. So, and that's at a time when our law schools have equal numbers of men and women and so on. So yes, we have three justices now on the Supreme Court who are women, but there is a lot of work left to be done.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes, ma'am.
This may seem silly, but I have a hard time with Citizens United getting my brain around why it's okay for teachers' unions, municipal unions, to give hundreds of millions of dollars to politicos, which I think in the state of New York is simply ruining the education system. You've got the political class determining the compensation for the people who are electing them. And where's the difference? Why is that okay, but not okay for certain people? And at the same time, the same people who are against the case were delighted with George Soros's efforts.
I think the basic question is, should there be unrestrained giving by any group, or should there be some ability to restrain contributions, whether by labor unions, corporations, individuals? That's the sort of foundational debate, is whether political contributions equal constitutionally protected speech, and if so, can there be any restraint of any kind? We're at a point now where there's really no restraint of any kind, and we're going to see, I think, some of the pernicious consequences of that. The impact that certain interest groups have had on politics is also well worth paying attention to, focusing on, and trying to manage and regulate. And I know Neil wants to add.
I was just going to say, put differently, Senator, I take it your constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United doesn't have an exemption for Soros and labor unions.
Correct.
It's across the board.
Correct.
Yes.
Jeff, could I add, if the Supreme Court is indeed acting politically, it's not really doing a very good job of it. Approval of the Supreme Court is at historic lows. Since 2012, about 50% of the American public has approved of the job the Supreme Court is doing. It's never been lower in 30 years of polling. That seems to be associated with a sense that the court is political. And we also see great moves in approval for the court coming after these various decisions. So after Citizens United, approval among Democrats of the Supreme Court fell 12 percentage points. I don't yet know what it's going to be after Obergefell,
But my guess is it's going to move in the opposite direction, but Republicans will drop. After Bush v. Gore, it clearly moved in the direction of conservatives, Republicans being more approving of the court. And I think Bush v. Gore may have been one of those decisions that resulted in the low approval ratings that the court currently has. They're higher than Obama's ratings, but they're low.
And not just Obama's. The good news for the court is they're more popular than Obama, than Congress, than the media, or than nearly any other institution in American life.
And they're still the lowest in history.
They're not as popular as the military.
That's one
institution that retains its popularity in American life.
That's an important note on which to end this extraordinary discussion. You have heard from this amazing group, which although it lacked race and gender diversity, had amazing intellectual diversity, that many of our commentators believe that the court is acting constitutionally and not politically, even though that may not be reflected in the polls. Now you, ladies and gentlemen, have some homework, and here is my charge to you. You've seen the incredible importance of these issues. You've seen the necessity of educating yourself from a range of thinkers, lawyers, senators, historians, and other thought leaders. I want you right now, before you leave the Aspen Ideas Festival, go to the Supreme Court website, supremecourt.gov, pick a opinion. It could be the marriage equality decision, it could be the healthcare decision, and read it. Read the majority decision, read the concurrences, read the dissents. It's not just for lawyers. You don't have to read every word. You can skim the longer bits. But these decisions are written for us. We have an obligation as citizens to educate ourselves about the arguments on both sides and then make up our own minds. Thank you for joining an amazing discussion.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. Corporate support for Aspen Public Radio's coverage of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival broadcasts come from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations, with offices in Aspen and Denver. More at obermeyerwood.com. You can access this discussion and all of our Ideas Festival coverage online, aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks for listening.